Good morning, everyone. I'm Mel.
And I'm Pippa. We're the creators and editors of Earthrights, the podcast and platform that focuses on the connection between human rights and environmental issues.
Just a quick message before we begin. The views and research presented on this podcast are either our own or referenced on our website, www.earthrights.co.uk. We generally always record a few weeks ahead of release, so some facts or situations may have changed during this time.
Hello! Welcome to episode 3 of Earthrights. Today, we're going to be talking to Mel about her research on human rights in Cuba. Cuba is the largest island in the Caribbean with a population of 11 million, and its current leader is Miguel Díaz-Canel, who leads Cuba within a socialist communist system, which he has taken on from the Castro brothers. Before we get into this podcast episode, we just want to clarify a few definitions. So there's no single definition of socialism, but for our discussions on Cuba, socialism means a one-party state system, so the Communist Party, a socialist legal system, a centrally planned economy with universal free social services, centrally run media, culture, and educational policies. So, Mel, tell us about why you choose Cuba and how you came to the decision to write your thesis on this topic.
Okay, so in 2015, I visited Cuba as a tourist, and I was really taken with all of the 1950s cars, the fact that it had no internet. You could hear jazz music throughout the city, even in parks. People were playing their trumpets and stuff. There were Castro and Che Guevara posters everywhere. It was just a cool and very interesting place to visit, and like the perfect getaway, obviously, without any internet and stuff. And so when you and I, so Pippa and I, went to a conference in Prague called the Festival Democracy Forum 2000. This was on Cuba and human rights in Cuba. And I was kind of shocked when we arrived because I hadn't realized quite the sort of oppression people in Cuba had. And I didn't really realize that all of the no internet, the posters everywhere of the dictators, I didn't really realize what that meant until we went. And the conference emphasized the denial of freedom of expression. It was called Not a Useful Artist. And it wanted to showcase to us and the attendees, independent artists and activists who were critical of the country's regime. So it just made me really fascinated with this country that I had thought was so sort of picturesque, and it gave a real dark side to it. So I was obviously prompted to go back, and I think I even remember saying to you after the conference that that was going to be what I wrote my thesis on.
Yeah, I remember.
And I knew I needed to therefore go back and visit and really get a better idea of what was going on there. So in 2019, I went to Cuba again for a month and stayed with host Cuban families and interviewed them. To see what their sort of thoughts and opinions were about the system. And I mean, quite obviously, perhaps, they weren't particularly critical in one way or another. They were all very passive aggressive, if they were aggressive at all, about the system. They didn't want to speak out too much, to be honest, for fear of me publishing a story about what they'd said and them being hunted down by the police and put into prison. The ideas they gave across were really useful because Cuba has a closed political system and doesn't let any international media outlets into their country. So by going there and understanding a bit better what life was like in Cuba, I could then sort of correspond that with what I researched with books and in the internet for my thesis. So it kind of just like helped me ground my research and overcome some of the censorship problems.
So yeah, so what led you to choose the specific research questions that you focused on? And yeah, just tell us a bit more about the questions.
So my research questions were, can the achievements of the Cuban Revolution be maintained in the human rights, legal and political system that Cuba has developed? And is the main problem in maintaining these achievements US sanctions or the prioritization of certain rights over others, which causes problems domestically and also provokes the US sanctions. So this might seem all rather wordy and sort of cyclical, but that was the very thing I wanted to get at. So the achievements of the Cuban Revolution I'll come back to, but in sort of trying to understand whether the main problem has been US sanctions or prioritizing certain rights over others, I was like very conscious not to get caught up in a trap of just analyzing Cuba's like poor record of guaranteeing certain human rights. So, I mean, the obvious approach to Cuba from a sort of critical point of view is that it doesn't allow freedom of expression, that it doesn't allow people to participate in voting properly, that there's like arbitrary arrests, et cetera, et cetera. And instead of sort of just repeating this, I wanted to not sort of, well, I didn't want to do that. And I wanted to not just also go along the line of the fact that there's been a dictator ruling Cuba, obviously Castro. I just thought it was all a bit sort of too simplistic. And also, where does the US embargo sort of come into all of that? The idea of prioritizing rights is maybe a little bit of a strange idea, but essentially this comes from the take that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights aren't actually universal, like one size doesn't fit all. And when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was first presented, there was a lot of sort of controversy and trouble because not every nation around the world was happy with all of the human rights there. So actually this, a Czech legal scholar, Karel Vašák, if I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he introduced categories of human rights, and he said that these are going to be important because one category of human rights will be better for certain nations and the other better for others. And so they kind of represent different moral, philosophical, cultural, political standards that nations have. So, for example, in the West, we might have a more democratic ideology, and therefore we want to prioritize civil and political rights, like the right to vote, the right to express ourselves, etc. Whereas socialist nations with a different thinking would prioritize economic rights and labor rights. But I also was kind of interested because of Cuba's history, which I'll come on to, about the fact that different nations have different needs. I think even I learned about the Maslow's hierarchy of needs in primary school. Pippa, have you heard of it?
No, I don't think so.
So Maslow had this triangle, and in each stage of it, there's like different needs of a person or a population. And I thought it was kind of interesting that countries might want to pursue certain human rights because of their needs. So like if our country is Cuba and people are struggling to get food and water and have adequate housing, then they're obviously going to prioritize rights that are going to facilitate them to have better food and housing and water. Whereas in England, for example, we've already got food and housing and water, or most of us have. So we're given different rights, like mental and thinking rights. So we want to be participating in the political sphere and all this sort of thing.
That makes sense.
It is not the absolute reason, but it just was another way of looking at why certain nations, particularly Cuba, tend to lean towards guaranteeing certain rights rather than others. And obviously, therefore, in prioritizing these, we have clashes. So like the US and Cuba don't agree on which rights they guarantee. And that's why generally the position on Cuba is that it's doing a really bad job of guaranteeing human rights, because all of us Western nations don't feel it does enough to guarantee civil and political rights. So back to what the achievements of the Cuban Revolution were. So everyone sees things like universal healthcare, education, subsidized transport and food as the main achievements, and the idea of a free, independent, sovereign homeland. So these were considered to be achievements because Cuba's history has been characterized before the revolution with foreign domination, slavery, capitalism, hunger, corruption, just sort of all evils, as it were, that Castro was then sent to change. So, I mean, Spain had been on Cuban soil since 1511, and then the indigenous population left, slaves were brought in from Africa. And even when Cuba tried to fight for its independence in the late 1800s, there wasn't a clear winner, and therefore the US occupied Cuba in 1898 to 1902. And even though it left Cuba, it sort of has maintained imperialistic control over Cuba. And there was a quote saying that it was a colony in all but name. So, I mean, even just on a side note, that's why Guantanamo Bay detention camp is on Cuba, because America introduced certain laws which allowed it to remain on its land indefinitely, which I think is really awful. I mean, I remember not really knowing what Guantanamo Bay was, apart from that it was a detention centre, imagining that this was an island in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of like the Pacific Sea, and to think it's on a nation's island.
Yeah, it's crazy. Did you see in the news recently that like politicians were discussing the potential to send like refugees to like an island in Virgin Isles or something? And even though that seems like outrageous now, to think you could just like place a prison on like foreign land, it's like the idea still exists.
Between 1900 and 1959, when the revolution happened, there was just loads of corruption. Lots of the politicians were rigging the elections. The US Army kept intervening in the elections. There were lots of white Americans and white Spaniards that had been given property rights as well during this time. And that gave a huge divide between the rich and the poor and caused lots of racism on the island. And then we had Batista, who was in power from 1940, and he had close ties with America and US and Sicilian mafia, which he paid huge money to. And I mean, Cuba was in a bit of an awful state. There was subhuman housing, mobs, drugs, prostitution, crime rate was really high, hunger, etc. And so, yeah, Cuba really wanted some change.
So, yeah, it's very clear from what you say that the Cuban people were very dissatisfied and they had no, like, option to vote out Bastia because he was the only, like, he was the dictator. So there was no, they didn't have any political freedom. So from reading your thesis, I understand that then Castro and his friends wanted to create change, which culminated in the famous 1959 revolution. So can you just kind of tell us a bit about the revolution and what actually happened? And, yeah, just understand it a bit more.
Yeah, so Castro and his friends tried to create a revolution in 1953 with a coup d'etat, but that didn't work. And Castro and his brother and their friends were tried and sentenced to jail. But he famously says in his speech that in trial, when he's defending himself, that history will absolve me. And so essentially he wanted to come back for more. He was going to be back and to ignite another revolution. He goes off to Mexico for a little while, gets some ammo and other revolutionaries. He also meets Che Guevara. And they plan their next revolution for 1958. They then sail on this famous tiny sailing boat called the Granma. And there's about 72 of them on board, and they somehow, against all odds, make it to Cuba, where they invade, and there's a sort of warfare in the Sierra Maestra Mountains with Batista's forces going against Castro and his forces. But in the end, on New Year's Eve, Batista gets up and flees, and the revolutionary government makes its stand on the 2nd of January 1959.
So this is kind of where the construction of socialism began. So, yeah, can you kind of explain what that actually means?
Yeah, so this process of establishing socialism started all because Castro wanted a complete change and reversal from what characterized Cuba before. So he wanted to obviously reject American Western principles of capitalism and democracy, just on the basis that they had failed the normal Cuban population and not provided them with anything. And this also meant that obviously, if he was going to be rejecting capitalism and democracy, he was therefore going to be aligning with the Soviet Union, because they were a sort of image of socialism at the time. They were the sort of characterization of socialism, if you can say it like that. Mm-hmm. Including with the economy. So Cuba was loaned hundreds of millions from the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union also picked up all of the leftover sugar quotas that America had dropped after the revolution. In terms of like the political philosophy of socialism, Cuba needed the Soviet Union for its factual status and dependence. It needed to have something to mirror. Also militarily, Cuba aligned with the Soviet Union, which at one point in 1962 culminated in the nuclear missile crisis, which, if you want some more information, I can point you towards some good books and chapters on the nuclear missile crisis.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Maybe you can send it to me, and then maybe we can put it in the show notes of the podcast.
Yeah, that absolutely. Castro also wanted to put Cuba on the world stage and show other nations that he was a strong leader, and that Cuba was a force to be reckoned with. And in doing so, he nationalized all the property so that American citizens who had arrived on the island could no longer own the property. He introduced national free services. So these were what became, obviously, as I said, the achievements of the revolution. So healthcare, education, transport, food, utilities, etc. And he overturned the illiteracy rate, built new schools, and things were looking up for Cubans. They were really pleased with what happened. But obviously, over time, this became a bit complex, tricky, and contentious. Mm. So
in your thesis, you talk about like the consequences of this being a restriction of freedom of thought and expression, with like limits to the press and censorship of media, and a loss of liberty kind of to speak out against the state. So what does this mean for human rights in Cuba?
Yeah, so obviously, as I was saying, with the way that certain nations can prioritize one set of rights over the other set, throughout the period of the revolution, there are huge restrictions to the freedom of expression, etc. And these are civil and political rights. So through legal and other means, Cuba has always, like in its modern revolutionary history, prioritized the economic, social, and cultural rights, which are universal healthcare, education. And in doing so, it's completely denied in both its laws and in reality some really basic civil and political rights. So what this really means is that whilst on the one hand, Cubans might have free healthcare, education, access to food, it also has to deal with day-to-day repression. So, for example, in 2019, Human Rights Watch stated that the Cuban government continues to repress and punish dissent and criticism of the system. Freedom House reported 1,800 arbitrary arrests of human rights defenders and independent journalists. And that's just for one month. And I mean, Pippa, do you remember meeting some of the artists at the Prague conference? These were the kind of people who had been arrested. I think some of them had said they'd even been exiled, so sent away.
Yeah, and it does definitely make those conferences that we just kind of like went to on a bit of a whim, like you realize how, because yeah, these were like activists in Cuba where it was impossible to be an activist. So you realize like how important it was what they were saying. and
giving them an outlet sort of thing. And on the subject of artists, so there's a really contentious law in Cuba called Decree 349 that was introduced in 2019, which requires artists to have a license to provide their artistic service, which, I mean, just if we think about it, is a bit of a catch-22. It's a bit ironic in that sense, because art is not meant to be something that is controlled or censored, but by requiring a license, it means that the government can have control over who it decides is worthy of producing art or not, which means in the end it can kind of decide how Cuban culture should look. Mm. Which I find really sort of find that quite dark. It's not like here where if you produce something that's a bit outrageous, you're not going to be sentenced to jail for it. Mm. I mean, the Cuban state does use many, many repressive tactics, which just have a silencing and punishing effect on basic human rights in Cuba. It uses the criminal code as well to crack down on any political dissent. The day-to-day living of Cubans are sort of on a knife's edge, I guess. You can't go too far out of line.
Mm. Yeah, the importance of, like you say, those like artistic rights and like the freedom of thought. It's, yeah, so important. And it's terrifying to think what life would be like without those freedoms. So yeah, so kind of moving forward a bit, how did then the collapse of the Soviet Union impact Cuba?
Cuba has always been quite economically vulnerable, particularly because it relied so heavily on sugar as its main export, but also because it relied so much on the Soviet Union for trade. So Soviet Union and all of the communist Eastern Bloc nations for trade. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, not only did all of those nations no longer have the possibility to trade with Cuba, but Cuba also wasn't given any help from the International Monetary Fund as other pre-Soviet Union nations did. Like, for example, the Czech Republic received help from the International Monetary Fund. So Cuba was really left on its own. And there was an essay actually by Emily Morris from the London School of Economics. Again, I can put this on the show notes. But she actually gave a sort of different view on Cuba and how it fared economically after the Soviet Union. And for example, she states that it was positioned 13th or 14th among all of the Comecon ex-Soviet Union nations in the aftermath of the collapse. And I thought to only be 13th out of a possible probably 25, 30, when it had absolutely no help from any external actors because everyone condemned it.
What do you mean by it was placed 13th? Like in?
So essentially that ranking was based on how well countries were doing after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
Economically. So the fact that it was 13th and not last, even though it received no financial help, was, I thought, quite impressive, really. I think also worth mentioning about the impact of the collapse of the Soviet Union was that obviously Cuba really relied on the Soviet Union for its socialist recognition and support. So this sort of political philosophy that really characterized the East, as we term it, during the 20th century, that was all of a sudden gone. And I think that was really hard for Cuba. Mm. Obviously, all of this culminated in Cuba's inability to fulfill its obligations to provide universal social services. And it meant that it couldn't guarantee the economic and social rights of Cubans because there was huge malnutrition, there were energy cuts, food rationing, which still exists today. The sugar industry obviously collapsed, and that was awful because it had no source of revenue after that. Also, in trying to deal with the collapse of the economy in Cuba, the state decided to introduce a dual currency system. So there were two types of peso around in Cuba, and this was to try and like get over the tax deficit that the state was facing. These two currencies, there's the tourist currency, which is convertible, a convertible peso, so you can exchange it for dollars and other cash, or you can exchange it into the national peso. But the national peso is worth far, far, far less than the tourist currency. Mm. And actually, this has culminated in a black market where you can buy and sell goods using the convertible peso.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, like this kind of forming of this like black market. Like there was one bit of in your thesis that I found really kind of funny, well, funny and strange, where you say that there was some representatives of the state ran an egg distribution market and were sent to prison for conspiring to divert more than 8 million eggs to the black market. Imagine being sent to prison for stealing eggs. So yeah. And so why did it come to this, where like political representatives were having to like make money this way? And
yeah, so the currency was introduced to try and tackle this tax deficit. Mm. In practice, this means that if you have access to the better faring currency, the more lucrative currency, you're going to naturally do better in life. You're going to have access to the black market, access to better goods and services, whereas everyone else who only has access to the national peso has weakened goods and services. And what I thought was really interesting, complete contrast to here, is that the people with no access to the black market and no access to the tourist currency, they were public sector workers. So you would be a doctor and you'd be earning, for example, $20 a month. Whereas here, obviously, if you're a public sector working doctor, you have a relatively good salary. Obviously, it all is dependent and relative, and people might shoot me for saying that. But
more than $20 a month, like you have a livable salary, but like above the minimum wage.
Absolutely. And so this is really rubbish for the people who are in public sector jobs. And this kind of makes people not want to work in the public sector. So that's awful.
It's like our friend in one of our good friends is from Ukraine, and like obviously also an ex like Soviet state, and her parents were doctors, which like in the UK you'd be like, wow, your parents are both doctors, like you, and like they are on such poor salaries and the country's so corrupt that they make most of their money from bribes. That's what like she said. And yeah, it's a similar situation, I suppose, where like working in public sector jobs is just like so badly paid, even though they've had years of training. And
It's exactly like that, and they do accept bribes. I mean, there's a funny word in Cuba. Well, sorry, it's not that funny. It's just the word they use, and it's called socialismo, and it basically describes the exchange of favors. And this, so for example, I'll give you a car ride, Pippa, if you can give me the fruits and other goods that you make on your farm that I can't get access to with my terrible salary. And this was really prevalent in even going and visiting Cuba. You would just get taxis, and when you were in the taxi, somehow your next move was already guaranteed, that because the Cubans would have sorted you out on the basis that they were doing each other these favors. And we'd be bringing back tobacco, for example, from the farms for one of the families that we were staying with, because he'd sorted us the lift. It was all very It was very interesting, but it's not a great situation to be in, because obviously it's very corrupt and
no one's making money. It's just like an exchange.
Yeah, no one's making money, and like with such an unequal access to the different currencies, it actually means that you have a very unegalitarian society. And I think that's quite ironic, given that socialism is meant to be creating an egalitarian society, and that was always what Castro's wishes were, using socialism for his system.
Just to say, as of the 1st of January of this year, the two currencies, so the CUC, which is equivalent to the dollar, and the Cuban peso, which is worth 24 times less than that, have now been unified. So the CUC, or dollar equivalent, has been abolished. And this has come at a time when the peso was being devalued anyway due to the coronavirus and its impact on economies worldwide. But more significantly, this is like a very long-awaited step for Cuba, and I think it can help to dry up this infamous black market that we've been talking about, which has created huge inefficiencies and inequalities within the population. And hopefully, I guess, it will make Cuba a more attractive place to work, particularly because... Yeah, part of Miguel's package, President Miguel's package, it includes increasing state sector salaries, and also includes reforms to the tax system. But from my point of view, raising the salaries of the public sector jobs is extremely important, because up until now, the salaries have been so low and paid in the Cuban peso that, say, doctors have started accepting bribes, and Cuba has experienced a brain drain, where many highly skilled workers have essentially left to seek better paid employment in the US or in South America. Yeah, I don't know what will happen in the future of this, as it's only really just been introduced. But if you're interested, I'm going to be posting on the Earth Rights blog tomorrow about the black market and ending the dual currency system.
Yeah, so kind of later on in your thesis, you talk about how, like, amongst all of this going on in Cuba, that Cuba is also really vulnerable to external instability. And you talk about the situations with the US and with Venezuela. So could you just explain this a bit more, and kind of how do you think Cuba can solve this?
Cuba is very vulnerable as a country, not least because it experiences loads of storms and environmental disasters. It's just like never really been able to get its foot in the door with into this sort of globalized economic door. Mm-hmm. And it just relies heavily on these mega nations and what they can provide. One quite nice relationship that it does have is with Venezuela, and Venezuela gives Cuba oil and petrol quotas in exchange for Cuba sending over doctors and nurses. Like, this is quite typical for Cuba to use doctors, teachers, nurses as an exchangeable capital, essentially. But this was all well and good until Trump announced that he was going to condemn the Venezuelan political system, the Maduro regime, and block the oil pipeline to Cuba. He owns it, again, typical, you might say.
Yeah.
But he therefore had...
But he specifically owns it, or like America owns it, or...
Yeah, America owns it. Good question. But obviously, having the state power, he mm-hmm. was able to just, at the click of his fingers, send not only Venezuela into disarray, but Cuba was not able to receive oil. So while I was in Cuba in September 2019, the whole economic industry, the transport industry, hospitals, was just in absolute chaos. Like, people just didn't know where to go. It was crazy, really.
Yeah. And that must have been very strange to experience, because there's like, we don't know, like, apart from like a power cut, like, we can't really, and like in the UK, we can't like experience that, like having an oil crisis where there is no like electricity or power, and like the impact, you say, like not even just on like transport and offices, but on like hospitals and people on like ventilators and that kind of thing.
That was actually one of the big, I'd have to find the article, but that was a huge issue. Ventilators were and just like critical life support were mm-hmm. stopped, and people were just furious, angrily shouting at the TV when Trump came on again, or when the Miguel Díaz-Canel, the president of Cuba, would come on and speak and try and reassure Cubans about absolutely about something that was absolutely not in his control. And it's just like how sad it felt to feel like there was someone with total control sort of stooping over you just little by little.
Yeah. So what happened when you were there? Like, did the oil kind of just come back one day, or like what did you do, and were you like stuck where you were and stuff?
So we couldn't get any public transport. That was the main issue for us, and we therefore had to pay for cars, so essentially private taxi services, which we were just running around the city trying to find someone who would be willing to take us to the next city, because most of them didn't want to do it because there was no guarantee they were going to even get back to their homes when there was no oil. And the oil prices just soared. So people were just angry. That's really the sense you got. Like the family we were staying with, the son was tearful watching the president and was just like, I hate Trump. When we were talking to him in Spanish, he was just expressing so much frustration. And you could just feel the way that another nation could be that imperialist.
Yeah. They're talking like about the power of America over Cuba. So like what impact did what is the US embargo firstly? And like, why is it there? And how's like going back to the first question is like, how did it impact human rights?
Yeah, great question. So specifically, the embargo is a series of statutes, administrative regulations, executive orders, and other laws which restrict trade with Cuba, and they also frustrate any possibility of a political relationship with Cuba. The most contentious laws, I would say, that uphold the embargo is the Torricelli Act of 1992 and the Helms-Burton Law of 1996. So the first of those maintains economic sanctions against Cuba. It terminates any foreign assistance and aid reaching Cuba. This includes from around the world, which would mean sort of aid in the time of a hurricane, for example. And it also obstructs Cuba's ability to trade. And then also the Helms-Burton Law tightens these restrictions. And it did this at a really critical time. So 1996 was obviously after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Cuba had fallen into economic austerity. This law was to try and sort of squeeze Cuba into changing to a democratic capitalist nation, and to improving its human rights record. These are really also quite important laws because they're acts of Congress, which means that the president has no ability to change them. So he would need to pass through Congress a change in these laws, which kind of means that Cuba is stuck with the embargo until Congress reforms or changes or takes a totally different position on Cuba. Also, what's not so great about the embargo is that it has an extraterritorial effect. So anything that's moving from say Europe to Cuba but is going via the US to Cuba, it can't then reach Cuba because it breaks that chain. I mean, in 2000, the embargo, there was a few restrictions lifted on certain agricultural commodities. So Cuba is allowed to access a little bit of trade with the US. As to why it exists, this is a really good question, and tying it in with why certain nations prioritize certain human rights over others. The US approach to human rights endorses the embargo against Cuba because it has support civil and political rights, and therefore it rejects Cuba's approach to human rights, which supports the economic and social rights. I think also we can put the embargo down to a sort of a long-term hatred for the revolutionary state. So, I mean, President Kennedy as early as 1962 introduced sanctions against Cuba. So it's a kind of, this embargo embodies a sort of pursuit against Cuba to try and change its human rights situation and bring it in line with the US position on human rights, in supporting, say, free speech political participation. But the problem with the embargo, so as to your question, Pippa, on how it impacts human rights in Cuba, in the basic sense, obviously restricting its ability to trade, it means that Cuba is going to have a hard time in providing the achievements of the revolution. So anything from healthcare, education, transport, it's going to struggle to provide these things. So with healthcare, most drugs and medicines come from the USA. And obviously, if Cuba has no access to these, it's going to have no access to the medicines, which means its healthcare record is going to suffer. There's also no aid or assistance during hurricanes, which means that people in Cuba are affected. There's no clean water. It's just a bit of a dire situation. They really do frustrate Cubans' ability to provide these services. And even, for example, there's a lack of trade of machinery and teaching materials and industrial materials. So schools can't get the books they need to teach English or maths, for example. And one thing that I thought was really interesting that the embargo frustrates is Cuba's ability to research. So by not being able to sort of share ideas and attend conferences with US academics, Cuban academics can't evolve and think of new ideas because it's completely concentrated within its own country. Like it can only access the resources it has and not get access to worldwide teaching. Mm.
So yeah, it's just like not able to be a part of globalization, as you said earlier.
Yeah.
Because it just has no like contact.
Yeah.
Ability.
Precisely that. And I would also argue that the embargo also affects the civil and political rights of Cubans. So Cuba obviously maintains that it doesn't want to allow any dissent or criticism of its regime. It obviously arbitrarily arrests people, doesn't allow free speech. And this is one of the reasons that the embargo exists, right? The US want to condemn the neglect of certain basic fundamental rights. But then you have this vicious circle where Cuba will react and go against the US for enacting the embargo and therefore sort of crack down on civil and political rights. So, for example, when President Clinton and President Carter relaxed the embargo, Cuba responded with letting out political prisoners. And when the Helms-Burton law of 1996 was introduced, Cuba reacted with even more draconian laws against political dissidents. So you can just see it's a sort of like extra political fight between the two nations. So yeah, that sort of ties up the US embargo.
Mm. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating hearing you talk about it specifically, because it is so like hearing the amount of like power that the US still holds over Cuba, you kind of can't really believe that this is happening today. Like it seems so like something that could have happened 100 years ago. So yeah, the more like I learn about it, the more you understand how awful and like unjust it is. And I think I definitely have to do more reading around this topic, because it's yeah, absolutely like fascinating to learn like how this all came, like to understand the bigger picture of it. And I think it's really important to talk about.
Yeah, actually, you've just reminded me, both you and I have listened to the American Democracy series I've seen on radio. And one of the episodes is about foreign domination of America and its sort of imperialist conquest. And we can obviously, again, reference that. But that sort of gives an even bigger picture on how America has hold of lots of different nations and how it kind of conquests to get other nations to adopt democratic capitalist principles, when actually, as I'm trying to sort of put across it, that might not be what's culturally, politically appropriate for every other nation in the world.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Mel, for answering all of my questions. So, yeah, see you next week.
See you. Bye.
If
you are interested or concerned by any of the issues raised during this podcast, then please get in touch at contact@earthrights.co.uk or visit our website www.earthrights.co.uk. You can find full recordings of all of the episodes on most podcast platforms or on the Earth Rights website, referenced in the show notes. We host a blog on there too, as well as recommendations and other information. Please also join in on the journey by following our Twitter and Instagram accounts @earthrights_.
If you would like to be involved in an episode of the Earth Rights podcast, then please also get in touch. This Earth Rights podcast was hosted, produced and edited by us. Music and sounds were specially made for Earth Rights by the Mowgli Wild Boys, who are currently recording a new LP at Circuit Studios in Nottingham. Please follow their Instagram and Facebook @Mowgli Wild Boys.